You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, colleges and universities across the country are grappling with issues of inclusion, free speech, and political correctness. We'll hear from one university president about how institutions can handle these issues in meaningful and productive ways. Now, protests have continued in Hong Kong's airport over the last week. This follows weeks of mass demonstrations and political crisis in Hong Kong related to an extradition bill, but also larger concerns over the treatment of Hong Kong by the Chinese government. Gordon G. Chang joins us now. He's author of the book, The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon has written on China and North Korea for a variety of publications and lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for nearly 20 years. Gordon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Rob.
Before we get into the protests themselves, can you talk about the unique status of Hong Kong as part of China?
Well, Hong Kong is called a special administrative region of the People's Republic, and there are two of them. One of them is Hong Kong, the other is Macau, which is close by. And Hong Kong is governed under a one-country, two-systems formula, which is supposed to have a high degree of autonomy for 50 years. And that 50-year period ends 2047. We're 22 years into it. And the status of Hong Kong and China's relation to it is really what has caused these protests now in their 11th straight week. But they do go back to April, so this is a long-running protest.
Right. There are fundamental issues that probably led to this protest. What was the spark, though, that made it break out this year in particular?
It was an extradition bill proposed by Carrie Lam, the Hong Kong chief executive, the highest political officer in Hong Kong, in the territory. She says that this was her idea, but most people believe it was initiative of Beijing. Under this extradition bill, it would increase by 20 the number of jurisdictions to which Hong Kong could extradite fugitives. And one of those 20, and this is where the protest stems from, one of those was the People's Republic itself. And people believed, and not just pro-democracy kids and general population, but also the Hong Kong business establishment was extremely concerned about being extradited into a mainland court where, of course, there's no rule of law and very little in the way of justice. So that's what's triggered the protests. But now the demands have gone well beyond that.
Right. Talk about how it's gone from a protest focused on this idea of residents of Hong Kong being extradited to mainland China into much wider demands from many people in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the protesters have what they call the five demands. And in those five demands, there is one for universal suffrage for the election of the chief executive of Hong Kong. That had been promised, but Beijing has not honored that particular pledge. And that's what led to 79 days of protests in 2014, the so-called Occupy protests. So those are one of the five demands. But the kids on the streets have other demands as well. And for instance, you hear some of them talk about independence from China. Some of them even talk about the removal of communism from Chinese soil. Kids are flying the Union Jack because Hong Kong was once a British colony. They're also flying American flags and singing our national anthem. And they're holding up posters asking for President Trump to come to their rescue.
How has the government of China itself been portraying the events in Hong Kong to its own citizens within the so-called Great Firewall of China with a heavily restricted internet access?
For about all until the last 3 weeks, almost every single mention of the Hong Kong protests was scrubbed from the internet in China. Starting about 3 weeks or so ago, there was a change, and that was when there was a protest at what's called the Liaison Office, which is Beijing's representative office in the territory. Students, one particular night, threw ink on the national emblem of the People's Republic, and Beijing then immediately pivoted. They started showing the images of the protests inside China itself and tried to stir up nationalist sentiment because the national emblem had been desecrated. And now Beijing talks about the protests all the time. Part of that, of course, is how the students are trying to create a secession from Hong Kong. But also, important for us, Beijing has been blaming the United States for both instigating and continuing the protests in the city.
talking about the latest on the protests in Hong Kong, what led to them. Gordon G. Chang is with us. He's the author of the book, The Coming Collapse of China. What have you seen from the American response from President Trump? And ultimately, does it matter what Americans say about what's going on in Hong Kong?
It's a lot of what America matters. But President Trump's response has been uninspiring. So, for instance, he said this is a matter between Hong Kong and China. And he's also said, well, he hopes it works out. He hopes it works out for liberty in Hong Kong, but also for China itself. And on occasion, he has also talked about the protests as riots. Technically, he was true on that, but that's not an appropriate comment from the President of the United States, considering what we have at stake. Beijing has been attacking the whole notion of democracy and American democracy. And so Hong Kong, in a very real sense, is the front line of freedom, not just for the people of Hong Kong, but also for ourselves as well. And Beijing has been calling the U.S. a quote-unquote black hand, in other words, responsible for the protests. So whether we like it or not, we are being tarred with by Beijing propaganda.
You've written a book about the possible collapse of China as we know it. You've written elsewhere more recently that these protests could be the inciting incident for some kind of collapse. China looks like this unmovable force at this point. How could we get from here to there?
Well, many Chinese dynasties have fallen from the periphery with protests and disturbances, and those have reverberated inward to the center of power. That's what could be happening right now. The thing that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, is concerned about is not that the people in the mainland are going to be sympathetic to Hong Kong people. But people in the mainland are notoriously unsympathetic to Hong Kong. But what I think Xi Jinping is worried about is that people in the mainland will be inspired by what people in Hong Kong are doing. So, for instance, people in Hong Kong have pushed Carrie Lam, the chief executive, around. They've got her to temporarily suspend the consideration of the extradition bill. And I think that Xi Jinping is worried that people in the mainland have their own grievances, especially because the economy right now is not doing very well. And because of all of that, I think that you could see a harsh reaction on the part of Beijing when they believe that there is a contagion from Hong Kong to the rest of China.
We've seen in the past, of course, the Tiananmen Square protests decades ago and that kind of harsh reaction you were just talking about from the government to quash that. What are your fears, I guess, of something similar happening now in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think that there's a real high possibility of Beijing deploying the People's Armed Police or the People's Liberation Army on the streets of Hong Kong. But I don't see that happening for a very long time. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, we're not seeing the contagion that I talked about. And there was a large protest in China in the first week of July, but it petered out. And so we didn't see simultaneous large protests in the mainland. Also, China is going to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic on October 1. So it's unlikely that they will do something to cause mass disturbance and disruption before that date. And then, of course, you have the UN General Assembly meeting in September. I'm sure China does not want this subject discussed in the global body. So there's a lot of reasons for Beijing to try to get through all of this. But the one thing from China's perspective is you don't see a diminishment of fervor on the part of the pro-democracy kids. And you don't see a loss of support, despite their violent tactics from time to time. You don't see a loss of support on the majority of people in Hong Kong who are not focusing in on the tactics of the demonstrators, but are focusing on the brutality of the Hong Kong police, because they've crossed the line a number of times recently. They're focusing on Carrie Lam's intransigence and on Beijing's encroachment. So people in Hong Kong, by and large, are still behind the kids.
Gordon, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Gordon G. Chang, author of the book, The Coming Collapse of China, looking at the latest in the protests in Hong Kong and what's led to the current situation. Coming up, find out how you can help identify and fight aquatic invasive species this weekend all over Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, learn about the upcoming Snapshot Day in Wisconsin and how you can help in the fight against aquatic invasive species. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about survival.
Dreaming can help some people get through incredibly difficult times. Madison's Tundalea Taylor talks about how daydreaming helped her overcome a major health crisis and appreciate everyday life.
You want to know what I love? I love traveling, great earrings and purses. I mean, who wouldn't love to shop every day, all day, with not a care or worry in the world? I envision myself walking through the airport with my favorite pair of Black Queen earrings, my cute matching crossbody purse, taking a first-class flight to the Bahamas. I find myself doing that all too often when I daydream. It was starting to affect my day job. Daydreaming was good to me until I had an unexpected visitor that would put my daydreaming into jeopardy. I had been feeling horrible for a few months. I was so tired, I almost couldn't make it to the doctor appointment. I finally dragged myself to the doctor. Never planned out in my mind that I would drive to the doctor, but I would arrive in the ambulance to the emergency room. 8 hours later, one doctor came in and said, "You look good compared to what your body is going through, so we're going to keep you overnight." I suddenly had a sigh of relief. After another doctor came in and told me he ran every test he could possibly run, and he said I had leukemia. Then I called my mom and said they think I have cancer, even though he was truly sure that's what it was. I called my mama because I wanted her to call him and tell him about himself. Don't be telling her baby she got cancer like that one time she told the school worker not to be talking down on her kids. Or like that one time she told our babysitter, "Don't tell us, we can't eat our food." Then, finally moved to my first room after being admitted into the hospital. It was the ICU. It was never told to me what stage cancer I was in. I was always told it's aggressive. After 8 rounds of chemo, after 2 bone marrow tests, after various trips to the hospital for infections, after losing my hair, after 4 non-successful tries of getting stem cells, after telling my son I had cancer, after not having an appetite, after many restless nights, after not being able to daydream about traveling to places with no signs of cold weather anywhere, I finally got good news. Besides finding out the chemo was working, there was no evidence of the disease. I got stem cells. I made them on my own with the booster shot, of course. For these new stem cells I was about to receive, I'm going in the hospital for 1 month, take chemo for 7 days. This may have been the hardest chemo I have ever gotten, but I made it to transplant day. Wipe my system out and receive a new beginning. It's like filing Chapter 7 bankruptcy in my body. I wanted to go home and heal there. I'm living my life after cancer. I enjoy every day as my last because I don't know how much time I have here. Wow. One thing I was always worried about is if the cancer will ever come back. The thing about cancer is that it's not a cure, so I'm not fully cured of cancer. I'm just living my life like it doesn't exist. This time when I daydream is really to take the trip to the Bahamas with my new surviving cancer earrings and I survived cancer t-shirt. The biggest daydream is really a reality because it involves being cancer free.
Tundalea Taylor's story came to us from the UW Odyssey Project. Taylor was also a guest on the new podcast Inside Stories, which features Madison storytellers and digs deeper into their lives. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you're looking to get out on the water this weekend and do some cool science along the way, you're in luck. Saturday is Snapshot Day, which means environmental groups are looking for volunteers to help identify non-native plants and animals that could pose risks to Wisconsin waterways and wildlife. Natalie Dutak is the Aquatic Invasive Species and Watershed Groups Manager at the River Alliance of Wisconsin. Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, give us a little history of Snapshot Day. How did this get started?
Sure. Snapshot Day, we are entering our sixth year, and this started as an initiative to kind of start monitoring aquatic invasive species at places where humans and the water interact. For rivers, that was bridges. We were finding that aquarium plants and other species were showing up at bridges, and so we thought, let's create this monitoring event where we can get people out and monitor those locations. And then over the years, and that was started as a partnership with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We've partnered with University of Wisconsin Extension now in about 2017, and we added lake protocols, and we have added wetland sites as well. So it's not just a river event. We are looking at lakes and wetlands and basically any place where aquatic invasive species might show up.
So if somebody listening volunteers, what are they going to do if they show up?
If you show up, there's about 30 sites across the state, and the first thing you do is, you sit down and you have a short training. You get to learn about the problem of aquatic invasive species. It'll be focused on the region that you're in. You'll learn a short identification, and then basically you group up and go out in teams on a scavenger hunt to find invasive species in the waters near you, and you get maps and you get all sorts of goodies, and then you bring those species back and help verify them at your training site.
I watched some of the videos here. It looks like you can opt for a dry approach or a wet approach, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It depends on the site. For rivers, we have the wet or dry approach. For lakes, oftentimes it is dry because you're just using a rope break from the shoreline, but we do have different methods, and we tell everyone to do whatever they're most comfortable with. So if you want to get into the water and it's safe for you to do so, go for it.
And bring your waders if you have waders, it sounds like.
Waders, yeah. I wear my Keens. I like to get my feet wet.
If people get there, they collect this info, then what? What does the info get used for about these? What people spot when it comes to these invasive species?
Well, so the first thing that happens is once they're verified, the information gets entered into the Surface Water Integrated Monitoring System, which is a database that the Department of Natural Resource manages. And that basically, it's used both by the DNR and can be used by the public. It allows, biologists and Department of Natural Resource aquatic invasive species specialists to manage populations. They can track where they are. If we find a new species that's it's a pretty good thing on Snapshot Day that they can manage that much faster than they would without that input. And then for the public, it goes into a series of maps that you can interact with, and it tells you what invasive species are in your water. So it lets you know what's out there and then prepares you a little bit better so you know what not to spread and where not to go.
Let's get into why we're worried. What kind of damage are we facing now and in the future when it comes to all these different invasive species in our waters here?
Well, sure. So, I mean, the number one factor from an ecological perspective is that we have healthy functioning ecosystems, and when an aquatic invasive species shows up, they disrupt that ecosystem. And what we're looking at are introduced organisms, obviously, that are often non-native, and they're highly successful and adaptable. So they can outcompete native species, the wildlife that people, rely on, whether you're hunting or fishing or just enjoying nature. Those animals and plants and birds, all kinds of species can be impacted by invasives. And then there's also the economic impacts for the state. Whether it's on a personal level, you have to clean off your boat, you have to manage your property for invasive species, that's a cost to a homeowner or a landowner. And then just the money spent statewide on managing the species in general, over $2 million have been spent managing invasive species in the Great Lakes Basin, and more than that within the Great Lakes in general.
If someone is sold on this idea and says, yeah, sign me up, where do they go to get signed up?
You can go to wisconsinrivers.org. We have a Snapshot Day banner at the top of the page, and registration, the event, everything is free, and we're still running that through tomorrow afternoon.
I keep hearing about different citizen science things where people, even without, you know, serious science training, can get out and help researchers, whether it's university researchers, state researchers, whatever. Are there other citizen science opportunities out there if people get a taste for this?
Oh, absolutely. There are several aquatic invasive species related programs, but University of Wisconsin Extension that I mentioned, they have another program, the Citizen Lake Monitoring Network, which obviously is a lake focus, but again, aquatic invasive species. There's also water quality monitoring options, native species monitoring options within that. There's also Water Action Volunteers. It's another great program, and that's more of a stream monitoring program. So again, it's a river-focused program.
And Natalie, you mentioned you yourself will be getting your feet wet. Is this an all-day event for people who are organizing this thing, dawn till dusk?
For the organizers, yeah. For the volunteers, it's only about 8:30 to 1. But yeah, I'll be there all day.
And what kind of invasive species in particular are you going to be on the lookout for?
So I'm helping out with the Door County event. And, you know, it's regionally specific, but I will be focusing on some of the species they have there commonly, which can be Eurasian water milfoil, you know, your rusty crayfishes. But I also like to put a spotlight on some of the species that aren't in the state yet, or the species that may be, you know, a problem with aquarium releases like water hyacinth, water lettuce. We actually recently had an illegal dump of red swamp crayfish. That's another one I want to let people know about, like, this, you know, this doesn't belong here, and teach them how to identify it.
Natalie, thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you have good weather on Saturday.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Natalie Dutak is the Aquatic Invasive Species and Watershed Groups Manager at the River Alliance of Wisconsin. She joined us to talk about the upcoming Snapshot Day on Saturday and how you can help identify and fight aquatic invasive species here in the state. Coming up, colleges and universities across the nation are grappling with issues of inclusion, free speech, and accusations of political correctness. We'll hear from a university president about how institutions can handle those issues in meaningful and productive ways. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the state of pensions in the United States and whether businesses and state and local governments are ready to meet their obligations to workers. Tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, state Republicans are again introducing a bill that would punish students who disrupt campus speeches and presentations. Under the measure, UW system students would face suspension for their second offense and expulsion for the third. One of the bill's authors, Representative Dave Murphy, told WKOW-TV in Madison that the plan still allows for protests and doesn't limit free speech.
There's just a myriad of things that you could do, but going in and actually disrupting that particular speaker would not be one of them.
That's what's going on in Wisconsin, but it's not an isolated issue. It's the latest example in a nationwide debate surrounding free speech, trigger warnings, safe spaces, and political correctness. Our next guest tackles those issues in his new book. Michael Roth is president of Wesleyan University. He's the author of the book Safe Enough Spaces, a pragmatist's approach to inclusion, free speech, and political correctness on college campuses. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, before we get to the modern day, you start off your book, Michael, talking about how colleges and universities have also often been the subject of criticism and worry throughout their history.
Yeah, I think as long as there have been colleges and universities in the United States, there have been people who are older than students who complain about the behavior of students. Sometimes it's complaints about their social lives. Sometimes it's complaints about their ideas. Sometimes it's complaints about their politics. But I think we're in one of those epochs where middle-aged people look at college students and say, what the heck are they doing? I think we have to have some historical perspective to realize that we often have trouble understanding the politics and the ideas of young people, and we have to make an effort to see things the way they are seeing them too.
That said, is there something different going on in our campuses these days? Are we at a unique point, even with that backdrop of complaints about what's going on campus?
I wouldn't say it's unique. I do think that there are some distinctive features to it, and some of them are a product of some very positive developments. Colleges and universities today have a greater variety of people attending them than, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago. And as a result, there are more tensions on a college campus than there might have been around social class, around gender, around issues concerning race and ethnicity. And I think that those are natural byproducts of people working and studying and playing together in ways that they might not have before. Look, America is a vastly greater unequal society than it was 50 years ago. Inequality has grown so dramatically. But on college campuses, whether a big public school like the UW in Madison or a small school like Wesleyan in Connecticut, college campuses are full of people from different backgrounds, different races, and it's natural there's going to be some tension around what counts as inclusion, what counts as legitimate protest, and what counts as authentic education.
One point that keeps coming up in your book is the idea that diversity, whether it's ethnic diversity, racial diversity, income diversity, intellectual diversity, that diversity in and of itself is seen often as a benefit. It is a benefit to the students and the community they study in. Can you make that case?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a case that's been made by scholars and by the Supreme Court for quite a while now. And we know that teams do better when there are people on the team from who have a variety of perspectives. Whether it's in a technology company or whether it's in a science lab or whether it's in a political discussion, your enemy is homogeneity. Your enemy is groupthink. And so what you really want to see on a college campus or in a classroom, I teach every semester, and what I really want to see is the ways in which students approach a problem or a work of art or a book with different perspectives. And I think that some of the fears that we see expressed around college campuses now is that the people have the same view, that there's political correctness or there's groupthink. But I really believe that, in fact, our job as teachers is to tease out the variety of perspectives and see which ones are more powerful than others. I mean, I do think you discover that not everybody is right, that there's a variety of views, but some of them may be better for the problem at hand or the cultural challenge at hand than others. And so the virtue of diversity is that it gives you a better chance to find a better answer to deal with the problem at hand.
One of the big controversies there, whether you're talking about op-ed pages or court cases, is how to get that diversity through the admissions process, whether there are quotas, which are generally banned under law, whether there are preferences based on race or income status. What do you see as a solid way to tackle that question?
That's a great question. And I think one of the problems is that when there are more qualified people who want to be in the same spot, there's just going to be tension around who gets to be in those spots. And I advise high school students and others who I speak with that to expand their notion of what school they really want to go to, because there are hundreds of great schools in the United States. And what happens is that people kind of flock to one place. And so, Wesleyan, for example, we take about 15% of those students who apply, but probably 75% are qualified to do quite well at Wesleyan. So to say that we admit the first 1,000 people we admit are much better than the first 1,000 people we reject, I think it's really hard to make that case. So I there's always going to be tension around access. A holistic admissions process that ensures that our prejudices don't get in the way of our selection, that we have a campus culture that is intellectually diverse and is diverse in terms of social class and religion and ethnicity and race, that I think gives you a better chance to achieve a powerful education that we want our students to have on any college campus. Quotas, I think, are ham-fisted. They get in the way of a subtle admissions process. But to say that we're just going to use like one test for everybody to take, that also usually results in people gaming the test, gaming the system, and not getting the kind of diversity and intellectual vitality you want from a class of students.
Talking to Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University, author of the new book, Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. Another issue that gets a lot of attention from media, and as we heard from state legislatures, including here in Wisconsin, Michael, is the idea that campuses are unfriendly to conservative perspectives, whether that's in the faculty that are hired or the treatment of speakers on campuses. That's an issue you tackle in your book.
It is, and I have this position that gets people annoyed on both sides of this debate, I'm afraid. I have called for an affirmative action program for conservatives. I think we do need more conservative ideas, not dumb, provocative ideas that are paid for by outside sources to come and unsettle a campus, but deep conservative and religious ideas to be represented in the humanities and social sciences. I think that's really important, and we need to work harder at creating authentic intellectual diversity on campus. But the idea that you somehow have to have state legislators protecting conservative provocateurs on campus by having people pass legislation in state capitals to dictate punishments for student protests, that seems to me to be crazy. It seems really just political theater. I often give talks at Wesleyan where the students are protesting. They're there standing on the stage with signs. They make it hard for me to do my job. But that's the price you pay. Now, if they make it impossible for me to speak, they should be punished. But every campus has its rules for doing that, for disciplining students who prevent speakers from making their points of view heard. And that should be done by campuses, not by politicians.
You make the case in the book that at its best, the intellectual discourse at the university can come out of the interaction from people of different backgrounds, whether it's atheists trying to get an understanding of a religious viewpoint or vice versa, civilians with no military background maybe being taught by a veteran. How can we make sure that when we bring people together from those and other different backgrounds that we have a constructive interaction, not a, I guess, destructive interaction?
Wow, that's a great question. And you probably see it all the time on your radio show, right? I mean, you could have some guests who it's, you're not going to have a good conversation. It's not going to be good for the audience. It's everybody who walks away thinking it wasn't helpful. And you have other times when you may not agree with the person on, or there's a couple of people disagree, but the discussion of disagreement is productive. And as teachers, that's what we want in our class. And we don't want everybody to agree with us as teachers. We want the disagreements to be productive. And by productive, I mean it leads the students to think about things that give more meaning to their lives or give them more skills to deal with the problems at hand.
We are talking to Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University, author of the new book, Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important is it to you that free speech be cherished on campus, even when that speech might be difficult? If you're a student yourself or a recent graduate, what did you think about the political climate, the free speech climate on your campus? Parents, if you're getting ready to send your kid off next month, what's your big concern for them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University. His new book is Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced a campus lately as a student, parent of a student, a faculty member, staff member, what do you see there when it comes to free speech, political correctness, openness to different viewpoints, variety of backgrounds for people there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll bring on a caller now. Ken is with us in Slinger. Ken, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just called to disagree with the guest, and I guess the whole premise of they want open-mindedness on college campuses, because I have three kids that have gone to college, and all three of them have learned that they have to write in a liberal point of view, otherwise they will get bad grades.
Ken, thanks for the call. Michael, Ken and his children aren't alone. There's that concern that professors are in effect, indoctrinating kids from a liberal perspective.
Yeah, I really don't see that. When I look at the people who graduate from colleges and universities across the country, they don't seem to be joining subversive groups plotting for a liberal takeover of the country. I do see a lot of students blame their grades on their failure of the professor or the TA to understand their point of view. What I also see are students who can impress a faculty member or a teaching assistant by taking a point of view quite different from the other people in the class. Now, it has always been the case that students at any college or university can feel that they have to please the professor. And if that is happening, then that professor is doing a bad job. I mean, I'm not going to say that all the time teachers are eager to cultivate disagreement, but they should be. And when I visit college campuses and universities around the country, I meet faculty all the time who are looking for students who take different points of view. Now, it may be that other students in the class don't want to hear different points of view. And the job of the teacher then is to prepare them to think critically and openly about different points of view. And I see that at many of the colleges and universities that I visit.
Thanks for that call, Ken. We'll go now to Bill with us in Columbus. Bill, thanks for the call.
Hi. This question is more to your speakers referencing diversity in the student body. You know, they want a diversity in support as far as race, religion, gender, and other things, but I don't hear them talking about veterans. Veterans make up 1% of the entire population of the country, and there's certainly a tiny minority, and, you know, their service has made the colleges, made the whole country, you know, possible by giving them freedom. And they've put their own education on hold to serve the country.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. And Michael, you address that in particular in your book, The Need for More Veterans on Campuses.
I do. I couldn't agree more with the caller. And at Wesleyan, we started a program some years ago now where every year 10 military veterans are coming to campus on full scholarship. And they have added immeasurably to the campus culture. They have different life experiences, different points of view, and they come from all over the country, and we have all the branches of the service represented, and we also connect those military veterans with veterans in the region around the campus, which improves the relationship of the campus with the city that we're in. So I think that the caller is exactly right. The colleges and universities should make an affirmative move to find veterans who want to be on their campus and support them so that they can get a great education because they've already contributed so much to this country.
And in the book, you talk not just about students, but having people there as lecturers, maybe professors.
Yeah, we've started a program where military officers who are also teachers, as they step away from their military service, we've invited professors to come and teach international relations and political science, and they bring a very different perspective about leadership, about strategy, and about politics than many of our other professors. And what we found is that our faculty actually are eager to talk to these military leaders about issues. They don't always agree, as you can imagine. But I think it's been a great addition to the campus culture, and I think it could really work very well at many different colleges and universities.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Michael Roth. His new book is Safe Enough Spaces, looking at issues on U.S. campuses these days. Back to your calls. Ed is with us, calling now from Edmonton, Alberta. Ed, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to throw a comment out here. I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I could not disagree more with this notion that somehow conservative voices are being silenced on campus. I mean, I myself was a lot more conservative when I was going to school there. I had a lot of conservative friends. I attended several conservative talks that were brought in by their speaker series. And I just don't really feel like their voice is being squashed. I mean, the only time I ever saw people protesting was when somebody was saying something that was overtly on its face racist or discriminatory. And instead, I feel like this bill that's going through the legislature is kind of rooted in this, you know, conspiracy theory culture that so many other things, you know, one thing that comes to mind, voter ID and this notion of, you know, massive voter fraud. where, you know, essentially if you're having trouble making an argument, if you're, you know, having trouble getting your ideas through, you know, there's some shadowy figure that's working behind the scenes that's silencing everybody's voice. And I'm sorry. I mean, the whole entire state, the whole entire country needs to get a grip. You know, this is about having conversations amongst people, and there is not some, you know, shadowy, you know, conspiracy that's working behind the scenes to silence the voices of conservative students. I'm sorry.
Ed, thanks for the call. Michael, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a great point. We've seen that college campus issues get weaponized by politicians trying to gain points or fire up the base. I've actually met with conservative and religious students on campus to check in with them, as I do with other groups. I remember talking with a guy who was very proud to be out there as a strong conservative voice. And so I said, do you feel you're discriminated against by your political science professors? That's his major. And he turned to me and said, are you kidding? They are so interested in me because I'm different than the other students. They're intrigued by my positions. And he said he felt sorry for some of the others because he actually learns to argue his position all the time because he's constantly in debate with people. And for him, that was made his education even richer.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ed. Sean joins us now in Eau Claire. Sean, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Sean?
Yeah, no. So I guess my thoughts are a little bit, you know, I'm working a little bit here. You know, I'm working in part with UW Eau Claire Institution. And it's something where, you know, as much as we're up in the Northland here, up in Wisconsin, you know, there always seems to be the status quo that up in these northern parts, people will say, you know, we might not be paying attention as much to these issues as people seem to think. But I think as much as it's a hot button issue and people are getting fired up about it in different ways, I think up here, you know, I think we're covering it pretty well, you know, despite what I'm hearing from some of the other listeners. And I think we're doing a good job. And I think it's something where obviously, you know, there's more that we can always be doing, you know, otherwise the world would be perfect and there would be nothing to complain about and there wouldn't be any issues. But, you know, we're developing pretty good support systems. And, you know, and recently, you know, even in the UW system with all this restructuring with the 2 years, 4 years, you know, that's something where there's been a lot of change going on. And so there's been a big opportunity for growth and movement in the.
Sean, I'm going to jump in. Thanks a lot for calling in. And Sean mentioned something that reminds me of something you wrote. He talked about support for students. Michael, you talk in your book about, okay, yeah, admissions, that's one thing, bringing in students from different backgrounds and low-income backgrounds, great. What do we do to support everybody to make sure they have a good experience and hopefully graduate?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I know that a lot of people focus on who gets in, and they focus on access. But what's really key is that once you're in, keep debt low and or zero, and help people graduate on time. We've started a program where people can graduate in 3 years rather than four and save a bunch of money. But however you do it, I think we have to pay attention to those people who are part of the school to give them the support they need to finish on time and to get an education that doesn't saddle them with debt. And I know the public system in Wisconsin has been famous for doing these things very well for a long time, and we need to protect that resource, not just for Wisconsin, but as a model for other states as well.
Thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Michael, your book is, I think, an effort to bring more light and a little less heat to our debates about what happens on campus. Do you think that's going to catch on? We're going to dial down the controversy and have more productive conversations?
Well, I wish that were the case. You know, I think that it's important for people to realize that there is a conversation to be had, that you don't have to take a side that excludes everybody else from who might disagree with you. Whether you're on the left or the right, you can find conversations that lead to better solutions for the problems at hand. And I do hope that in this highly polarized environment, there will be some voices that call for further conversation so that we can figure out a way not to just yell at each other and be outraged at each other or be condescending to one another, but that we can actually work together.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University. His new book is Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we've seen a lot of flooding in Wisconsin in recent years. We'll look at the places affected and the damage done and find out how some communities are changing their game plan for the floods of the future. And there are a lot of scams out there claiming to be part of the Equifax data breach financial settlement. We'll find out how to avoid getting ripped off. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, the Milwaukee area is known as one of the most segregated communities in the country. Kate and her guests look at that segregation and how it affects crime trends in the metropolitan area. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a business reporter about how shoppers and communities were impacted by the closing of Yonkers and Boston stores in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.